Hello, I'm Christopher Cassan, and this is Ireland's Edge. On today's episode, Everybody Hurts, the future of Irish healthcare. Once again this winter, Irish hospitals have been overwhelmed, with thousands of appointments cancelled, hundreds lying on trolleys waiting for beds, and staff once more having to complain about unsafe and unfair working conditions. Last year, my father contracted COVID-19 and spent 3 months on a ventilator in the intensive care unit at University Hospital Kerry. Visiting him every day, my family and I saw up close the incredible level of work and care that our nurses and doctors provide, as well as the huge range of frustrating problems that they and their patients have to deal with. We are extremely grateful to the staff who helped Dad recover enough to return home after nearly 9 months in hospital. But where do we go from here? On today's episode, I'm joined by three women who see the healthcare system from very different angles. Professor Sarah Burke is Director of the Centre for Health Policy and Management at Trinity College Dublin's School of Medicine. Dr. Monica Oike is a GP based in Cork, whose advice on women's health is often featured on television and on her social media channels. And Phil Nihay is the General Secretary of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. At Ireland's Edge in Dingle, I spoke to them about how we can bring people together to improve our healthcare system.
I'm joined by three amazing people who have different experiences of the healthcare sector. I have Phil Nihay here, who is a local woman and General Secretary of the Irish Midwives and Nurses Organisation. Dr. Monica Oike, who is a GP in Cork, who many of you may know from her wonderful social media posts about women's health and public health in general. And we have Professor Sarah Burke from Trinity College Dublin, who works a lot on health policy, who many of you may know from appearances on the radio and the newspapers and so on. And we're going to be talking about trust. We're going to be talking about the future of healthcare in Ireland and what maybe can change and what the experience is like for people working in a service that all of us in different ways every single year experience for ourselves and our families. Sarah, I wonder if I could start off by asking you a kind of a big picture question about where we are with healthcare in Ireland, because we're in the middle of a reform programme, Sláintecare, and a lot of people probably have some experience of that, maybe with the expansion of GP care and free GP care and stuff this year, but a lot of people probably don't actually understand what's going on. And a lot of people are at times very cynical about the health service because of their own experience. If they have a bad experience, they tend to, especially at this time of the year when people are waiting and so on. Where are we in terms of reform of the health service in Ireland at the moment?
Lovely question to start with, Chris.
ICC Saturday morning.
I teach undergraduate medical students who aren't at all interested in health systems and policy. They just want to do the clinical work. And I say to them at the beginning of class, if you're to remember one thing from this class, remember the aircraft carrier. And I use that, and it's used in the literature, as an analogy of how difficult it is to change the course of a health system. So health systems tend to be on a particular trajectory, and it's very, very difficult to change that trajectory. And in the academic literature, it's called path dependency. In horse racing, it's, you know, past performance is a good indicator of future, you know, whether you win the race or not, right? So I actually think, and it's probably a quite unpopular view to have, but I think the Irish health system is a much better health system now than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And I think against the international norms, we're turning the course in that right direction. And in terms of what Sláintecare is, so Sláintecare is a national health policy. It was actually devised by our politicians, and to declare my interest, I was part of a technical team from Trinity that worked with the politicians for 6 months to devise that committee. And I had a much higher opinion of politicians, having worked with them closely for 6 months at the end of that process, than I did before it. And they came to this consensus under the very able chairing of Deputy Roisin Shortall of this sort of long-term plan, a 10-year plan for universal healthcare. Ireland's very unusual in a high-income country context in terms of the extent of our inequalities. So anyone who has had experiences, you've had very good experience, and often that critical care bit in our system is really good. But trying to get into the system and trying to navigate your way through the system is extremely difficult. And also, we're way too overly centred on the hospital. So Sláintecare is about way more early intervention, prevention, providing much more care in the community. We're not too bad at those big, hard, acute diseases. So we've got good, really improved our outcomes on stroke and cancer care, but still a laggard in terms of our management of chronic diseases, which is actually the thing that inhibits most people to live good quality daily lives, and particularly as we age or as we have disabilities. So it's about really shifting that system so that we get much better access to the care we needed. So an example of that would be if you have a chronic disease, and Monica would deal with these patients all the time, we know the outcomes are much better for people who have a really good understanding of how to care for themselves, but critically those who have access to a specialist nurse. So doctors are important, but actually nurses are way more important. So it's about reorienting the system. It's also about providing equal access. So at the moment we have people who can afford to pay can often get into the system quicker and faster, and trying to undo that. In terms of where we've got to with it, it's a slow journey, but big system change takes time. So my analogy would be is that we've managed to steer the ship in a much better direction, and that we're moving slowly towards that better direction.
Like Ciarán Rodarán, we're getting there. We're not just not sure when yet.
Interestingly, COVID has really enhanced that. While COVID interrupted the reform process, a lot of what happened during COVID was we had universal care, free at the point of delivery, everybody in the system together, all new services and being introduced by the current minister, Stephen Donnelly, are actually universal free at the point of delivery. Big push on women's health. We've been really poor on women's health services before. So there's a lot, an awful lot of good that's happening despite frustrations with people who use the system that there's not enough good happening quick enough.
Monica, a lot of that relates to your work where, you know, Sarah's talking about how there's going to be a greater emphasis on care in the community, on primary care. A lot more people this year who have free GP care, and as you say, a lot of new initiatives on women's health, which I know is something that you work on a lot. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your experience of being a GP. Like, what's it like? What has it been like for you moving down to Cork and starting in a GP practice at a time when, you know, none of us expected a global pandemic, and that put a lot of strain on GP services, obviously, in the last few years have been. What has that experience been like for you?
Hi everyone. So I was born in Nigeria and I grew up in Dublin. So after college, I moved to Cork for my intern year. And that was 2014. So in the past 9 years now, I feel like I've seen different phases of healthcare in Ireland. So I finished my GP training in 2020, which was right in the middle of the pandemic. So at that point, very few people were coming to the doctors. So we saw that there was a rise in chronic cases in terms of, like, cancers, and that was all due to like access and education and just fear of the virus. But I would say in the last 2 years, there's been massive changes in terms of like women's health and when it comes to the free contraception. And I'm seeing lots of younger people coming in to access the free contraception as well, in terms of also now it's been extended to age 30s as well. Then we had something called the chronic disease management, and we're now being focused on people that have like diabetes, hypertension, and there's a lot of education going through that as well, and also mental health resources. So over the past few years, I feel like it is getting better. I know sometimes people might think everything is just falling apart, but there are certain changes certain things in Ireland, in the Irish healthcare that has been improved. So it's on the way up, I think.
Bill, one of the phrases that I hate to hear on the news is talking about people who are on the front line in the health services, if we're talking about a war all the time, which is maybe not the right language to be using, especially when we see war happening as well, which thankfully we don't have to deal with. But what has been the experience for nurses over the last few years? I mean, obviously the pandemic put enormous demands on nurses working in very dangerous conditions, often obviously, you know, with overwhelming numbers of people getting sick because of a pandemic. But obviously there's also been, as Monica and Sarah have been talking about, a lot of changes in the health service which impact on nurses as well. What is the kind of state of nursing in Ireland, and what is the morale of nurses after all that?
That's going to take a while, that question. just Tom on a host of a hotsos gurmaha gov asankrita. I think the theme of today and trust and all that, I think the way I looked at it when I was just preparing for this was the people who are sitting here will be relying on the public health service. We're often criticised, I'm often criticised for only talking about the bad things. And I think that may be fair criticism, but I think we take the role as the Nurses and Midwives Trade Union very seriously in pointing out where the policy, like that Sarah set out, the slaughter care policy, and the real original direction of that was something else. It was unique. And it hasn't really been, you know, steered, I think, as quickly. We thought in 2017 the world might change. The big problem in the health service is access. It's getting in and sometimes getting out. But in the main, it's getting in. When you get in, you get good care. There's no doubt about that. And I would say to anybody here, you know, you'll hear us talking about trolleys and all that. That's a measurement of capacity. We need more capacity. If you're admitted to hospital and you're sick enough to be in hospital, well, then you should have a bed. It's fairly basic. The problem we have is there is no alternative. There's a slow move towards the alternative. You'll hear the development now of community services. Largely their focus and what Sláintecare intended was you should be kept as well as possible in the community for as long as possible. That takes services, it takes investment, it takes public health advice, it takes, for example, going to the mart here in Dingle and checking the blood pressure of the farmers so that they don't get a stroke. Small, simple initiatives that have worked, that have proven to be very, very good. And, you know, we know communities are different. We know that rural communities are different to urban communities. All of that research, Sarah's better able to discuss that than I am, has caused the Sláintecare Foundation to be very solid. So areas, depending on your community, we've an elderly community here that would be, you know, in need of long-term care at some point. And we know we have a hospital very close where 15 beds have never opened. Fabulous facility. Why? Because they haven't staffed, they haven't invested in staffing. So there's a couple of things I think that nurses would say regularly, and midwives. Firstly, you cannot divorce the provision of public health services from people. So now we are battling at the moment with a moratorium on recruitment. I mean, it makes zero sense that that should be the manner in which the health services saves the overspend. Mm-hmm. So there is an overspend, there's no doubt about that. But in order to come within budget, we cut our lifeblood, which is our staff. The Nursing and Midwifery Register issued its state of the register yesterday or the day before. There are 15,000 nurses who trained in India working in Ireland. There are 5,500 nurses who trained in the Philippines working in Ireland. There are just over 700 nurses who trained in Nigeria, 600 in Ghana, and some of the other African countries are slightly lower, 3,500 trained in the UK. So we are so dependent on overseas recruitment. It is just something that I think I'm constantly saying to the HSE, to the minister, you know, if you don't get it right when it comes to recruitment, forget all your policy, forget all your development, because you're never going to replace, and you should never strive to replace, the human interaction with patients, because that's the whole point of trust. That's where you get the good outcomes. Like you were saying about your father in ICU.
Yeah, and that was something, I mean...
Machines have a lot to do with good care, and we've progressed a lot, and we can do a lot more, and we can be more efficient. But for human beings to survive and to flourish, they must have the human interaction.
And it was really so noticeable to me and my brother and to our family, as you mentioned there, the people from all over the world who are working in our hospitals, who have, you know, doing unbelievable work, having travelled halfway around the world, maybe to train and here and so on.
Again, sorry for interrupting. A lot of our Indian colleagues, they're women, and they leave their children in India to come here, to have a better life, to send back the money, like my parents did. They left this peninsula, went to America, sent home money to their parents. And that was in the 50s. And, you know, thankfully they were able to come home and make a life here. But our Indian nurses now, many of them are very young women. They leave their children with their own parents or maybe with a sister. And lucky we have a visa in this country that allows them repatriate their husband and their children after a year. So they have to work for a year. They're on a critical skills visa. If they work in the private sector, They are reminded of that a lot. We've represented nurses, for example, who've been asked to do crazy things like mind their employer's children, provide cleaning of the outside of the nursing home, physical work that is not within their scope. That's not why they were recruited. But they're terrified that their visa will be impacted and they won't be able to bring their family.
It's just not acceptable. You know, it's not like
we have a lot more to do in respect of how we integrate the people we are so dependent on who come here, who keep our health service going. The minister made a speech about this in the Dáil, I think it was Wednesday evening. The trade unions had a march in Dublin on Monday where we absolutely rejected what had happened the previous Thursday night. We work alongside nurses and doctors from overseas, you know, for the last 20, 30 years. And without them, we would have a huge problem. We have a bad access problem now. But I think, anyway, the trade unions had, we had our march on Monday. The minister made his speech on Wednesday. And very welcome, I think, and very right to do that. But we have lodged a claim for an integration officer in each of the new regional health authorities because we need it. We need the nurses and midwives and doctors who train in Ireland to understand what it means. And Monica,
yeah, I wonder if I
might
can
be
ask
better
Monica
at
this,
describing
actually.
This.
Yeah. Monica, what, you know, you came to Ireland as a child, you grew up in Dublin, and then you wanted to become a doctor.
Yeah.
What was the process of training to be a doctor like as somebody who came from abroad, and especially as a black woman, like what was it like going to medical school in Ireland, doing your training in Ireland and stuff? Like, was that made easy for you, or was it actually made very difficult and a challenging experience?
It was definitely not easy. So I suppose I grew up in Blanchardstown in Dublin. It's a multicultural town. So I didn't really feel out of place until I got into college. I went to Trinity College. So in the class of 160 people, I was the only black Irish person there. And it was always like, whenever I was having a conversation with anyone, it was like, so where are you from? And I'm like, I'm from down the road, like I'm from
Blanchardstown.
So it was that always that expectation that, oh, I was from some kind of exotic place and I knew certain things. I remember, and I always remember this experience when I was in fourth year of medical school, and that was when we're doing a course in OBGYN, and they were talking about FGM, so something that's quite common in Africa. But the professor that was teaching us just pointed at me and asked me the question like I should know all about it. And so those experiences weren't really great, but going to medical school was a goal of mine, was a goal of my late mom as well. So that was my thing. I was going to survive. I was going to thrive no matter what happened. And then I think because of that experience, when I was applying for internship, I just wanted to be out of Dublin. I just wanted to start anew. So that was when I came to Cork. So I came to Cork and Kerry. And it was always, so where are you from? And I was like, I'm from Dublin. So I think, in a way, it was 50-50. I did enjoy the interaction, but sometimes I was just sick of it. And there was that lack of trust as well, and a lack of trust in my competence and also in my communication as well. Yes, my accent could be different, but if you took your time to listen to me, you would understand what I was talking about. So I did experience that for the first few years, but I think, like I said, I think maybe I'm just a very optimistic person. It does get better as the years go by, but it definitely wasn't easy. And I think as a black person or even a person of color, you would always have that interaction with people. And hopefully most times they don't mean any harm. It's just out of curiosity. Mm. But we do get sick of it. And I think it does impede our experience sometimes.
You mentioned that issue of trust in your competency there, as if people are challenging you because of you know, what you look like, where you come from, your accent and stuff like that. You do a lot of social media trying to dispel certain myths about health that people end up getting from Dr. Google or bad rumors and things like that. What is the reaction that you've got from people to your public advocacy around health?
It was pretty much the same thing at the start. So I remember when I started doing my videos, I always had to introduce myself. I said, I am a doctor. And you'd have people in the comments saying, are you sure you're a doctor? Where did you go? It was just like, after a while, like I said, I really did get sick of it. So unfortunately, I can't change the color of my skin. And there's always going to be that, oh, where's she from? And I've just learned to live with it and roll with it, to be honest. But it's there. It's always going to be there.
Yeah, well, as you know, from my experience, I can say, like, anybody who doubts the contribution of people from all over the world to the health service in Ireland only needs to spend any time in a hospital or doctor's surgery and, like, see that they're the people who are keeping the whole thing on the road. Sarah, can I ask you about something that Monica said there about that idea of trust in competency? Like, do people trust the health service in Ireland? Or is the kind of endless negativity that we get sometimes in the media and then the experiences maybe that people have, you know, because sometimes people don't interact with the health service until something goes very wrong, right? You don't, ideally you're not going to hospital all the time. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, to be honest. But, you know, if you're healthy, then it's when something bad happens. So then you have a experience that is not obviously someone you want to remember. Like, do people trust the health service? Is it something that we see as something that we have a stake in, we're invested in, or are people skeptical and mistrustful of the system that they maybe don't understand?
Well, if we use John O'Halloran's advice, which is what does the data tell us? So we do ask this question to people, their opinion polls, going, how much do you trust the health system? And before COVID, about 2/3 of the population had medium or high trust, not just in the health system, but actually in the HSE, which many would say is a toxic brand. But actually 2/3 by international comparative standards is quite good. And post-COVID, that figure went up to the high 70s. And I haven't seen, that's a figure from 2022. So that would indicate that actually most people, the vast majority of people, do have trust in the health system. Obviously, that trust is undermined by people who have difficulties in accessing care, by people who have poor experiences of care. But there is actually a large sense of trust amongst the Irish people. And in the literature on trust and health, there's two other really core components. So there's what the public, does the public believe in trust? And obviously misinformation and disinformation and COVID can potentially really undermine that trust. So that's definitely one to pay attention to. But the two other barometers that are measured sort of internationally is how much do the workers trust the health system? And actually in terms of quality of care and outcome, that's the most important indicator. So if the people who work in the system feel valued, are trained, have progression routes, work in multidisciplinary teams, see more positive outcomes, you actually have much better outcomes for patients. So that's a really important one. And the HSE does also measure the workers' views of the system, and the levels of trust of workers in the system is actually much lower than the level of trust of the public in the system. So I think, and therefore, to sort of circle back to the original question around reform, I think the only way you deliver on reform is if you really begin to nurture and increase that trust that workers have in the health system, because that keeps our really good, skilled workforce that we have, but it also makes it more attractive for our nurses and doctors that have had to emigrate over decades, and other loads of other clinicians and healthcare professionals to come back here. So I think it's a really important, and it's considered a sort of soft measurement, but actually as we get more and more data on the impact of that worker well-being on patient outcomes, systems are beginning to pay more attention to it. And then the third really important component is, how much do the stewards of the health system, of the health system, trust the health system? So that's, in plain English, is the politicians. And how much do they invest in it to actually really reform it? And we don't really have measurements. You know, that's a trickier one to measure. But in an Irish context, I think the player to watch there is the role of the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. So while there's a lot of rhetoric from the health minister and from the Taoiseach and even the Taoiseach, former health minister, about reform, at the end of the day, it's the people counting the beans in the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform who make a choice that leads to the moratorium that Phil talked about. So Phil, I think it's useful to think about in those different components rather than just as...
Phil, can I ask you about that? I mean, I remember when I was in college, I lived in first year with 6 nursing students, which was a weird experience.
You had a lot of drinking, so I'd say.
They were all from Westmeath as well, which is but they all ended up working abroad. And I saw you had, the INMO had a survey earlier this year of how many intern nurses and student nurses at the moment are considering emigrating.
Intending, yeah.
The number is huge, right? But I noticed in that survey, a lot of them said that if the conditions and the pay and everything were better, that they would actually prefer to stay at home. Like, it wasn't that they're going off for adventure. They're leaving because the conditions that they are being asked to work in are not great. And as we mentioned, a lot of the people who are being brought in or are coming in from abroad, recruited to work, are being given pretty poor conditions to work. And so what, you know, Sarah mentioned there about how important it is that the workers have trust in the system. Do nurses trust the health service?
That's a difficult one. I think they trust their own ability to do the job, but have they sufficient tools to do it properly? No. So, for example, take midwifery. So midwives are supposed to have a ratio of one midwife to 29.5 labouring women or women who are attending the service. And the average in this country is about 1 to 40. There's a couple of units with 1 to 80. I mean, that's just simply unsafe. And likewise, the literature and all of our research tells us that a nurse in an acute hospital on a medical or surgical ward should have responsibility for 6 patients, 1 to 6. In this country, we have, on a good day, you've 1 to 12. And at night, on night duty, that goes up. That goes up to about 1 to 16. So you can't answer the call bell as quickly as you'd like. You can't give the medicines on the time that they're prescribed. So that all leads to increasing length of stay of patients and poorer outcomes. We know all of this. This is all scientifically examined. So what's the answer? The answer to your question is, when we have policies, and we have a very good policy now, which is the framework on nurse staffing and skill mix. What does it mean? It designs the nurse-patient ratio. It says this is what it should be. Government have adopted it as government policy. And where it's in place, it's brilliant. It improves retention. People like working on wards that are properly staffed. They don't mind going to work when they know when they go in, they're going to stay on that ward and deliver the care, and there's going to be enough of them. So on the areas where it isn't in place, because we haven't funded it properly, nurses will say to us regularly, this is a joke. I go home every evening saying, what did I forget to do today? Oh, that man asked me to do this, and I just didn't get to it. You know, so that's the system. But I think one thing that we haven't touched on here, and it's just something this week, we were doing interviews. We have a post of a student and a new officer. It's basically, we ask a nurse to come in for 2 years who's recently qualified to work with the union to help those that have recently qualified. And it's a good post. So we had interviews this year because it's the 2 years of the previous candidate has just concluded. And I just got a bounce in my step from what those young, newly qualified nurses were saying, because their whole focus was on patient care, entirely on patient care. And we're doing something right in our training, in our undergraduate training, because the focus is on making sure the patient's journey is as best as it can be. And that's the mark of a good clinician. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very familiar with the open disclosure legislation, very familiar with patients' rights, very familiar with their role in advocating for the patient. And that must be a huge issue, I think, for people who are dependent, to know that we're getting better at training, we're getting better at patients' rights. And I think it would be remiss of us in the health area not to talk about Vicky Phelan and what she did to, you know, push that agenda. Ask questions. Don't just take the answer you get. If you don't have access to your notes, you're actually entitled to that. So people who go and interact with the health service have a lot of rights, have a lot of legal rights now, and they should be facilitated. The days of when you have to fight and go to the courts to get access to your information, they're gone. So that's good news. That's a much more open
Phil,
system.
Yes, Phil, when people are asked who's the professionals, who do they trust the most, doctors tend to come out the top. And I'm not sure that's such a good thing either, because I think people
pharmacists are now the top. Okay. But in the sense that if nurses are next, doctors, weather forecasters are down the list.
The doctor's always right, you know, then often that's when the patient's voice is unheard, and often women's health issues are ignored in that, you know. So there's.
I wonder if I could ask Monica about that. I mean, as a GP, you're, you know, obviously, when we talk about patient journeys and pathways and everything, like, there is obviously supposed to be a sort of a link in the chain all the way up. You know, you go to your GP, hopefully the GP practice has a practice nurse, you have to work together, and obviously that, if it has to escalate up through the hospital system, then everybody works together. Is that your experience? Do you think that there is this, like, integration between the different people who can, you know, you can just pick up the phone or get your practice nurse in, or is it actually not as connected as it should be?
One of the reasons I decided to be a GP was just because of the holistic care with the patient, you know, knowing about almost everything that happens with the patient, even in their personal life and all. And I think due to that, most patients hopefully would have a trust in the GP, especially if there is a really good communication and they also trust their competency. Now, in terms of the communication with other, I suppose, allied health services, sometimes it's very good. I think it's based on your location and also the people you're dealing with. I've seen recently now there are certain hospitals in Cork that would send their discharge letter to the patient and also to the doctor as well. So even sometimes, by the time I haven't even seen the letter, my patient's coming in with the letter. So this happened and this happened and this happened. Can you tell me all about that? Mm-hmm. And I love that because now there is that joint decision making, which I feel healthcare should be all about, because no one is going to know you better than you. But then again, it's always good to also have input from healthcare services that do have the background that could help you as well. So when it comes to Ireland, I think you might even see this as well, that there is a lot of mismatch in the healthcare system there. In some parts of Ireland, they have those really great services, and in some parts, they don't even have, not, I'm not, so like, just from my experience, I was working in Galway a couple of months ago, and certain things like testing for like vitamin D, in some practices, they didn't have that. Meanwhile, in Cork, we could do that. So yeah. There is no, what's the term? There's no
consistency.
Exactly. There is no consistency in healthcare. And if we can achieve that, I think patients' experiences will be improved, the trust in healthcare will be improved. And also for us as healthcare professionals, it would also help us, because then we'll know that no matter where we go in Ireland, this is the standard of care the patient is going to get. Yeah.
As we come towards the end of the discussion, Sarah, I wonder if I could loop back to the beginning there, because like a lot of what you are all telling me, and what it's certainly my experience of the health system as well, is like nurses and doctors and the people in the health service know what works. They know what needs to change. They know what would make their jobs easier. They know how to do their jobs, etc. And yet, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, at times it feels that in terms of investment, that investment isn't necessarily going in the right places, especially if like the idea is, you know, we do spend above, you know, the European average quite a lot of money on healthcare, and yet we have a recruitment freeze at a time when there are people on trolleys and unstaffed wards and lack of practice nurses. That, from a layperson's perspective, doesn't seem to make a lot of political sense. What is required to change in terms of our attitude as voters, as citizens, and the attitudes of politicians, that the money goes in the right place? Because I don't think that people are averse to spending money on the health service. They want to see that. They want it to be good. But it doesn't seem to be always going in the right place.
Yeah, and perhaps a good example of that is if you look at just the headcount in terms of the number of people that HSE currently pay, there are 42,000 more people now on HSE payroll than there was in 2019. So that's a huge, it's gone from about 120,000 to 162,000. But actually, if you break that down, just ballpark, 25,000 of them are in hospitals and 15,000 of them are in the community. And actually, for Sláinte Care to work, for Monica to be able to provide integrated care in the community, yes, the hospitals are jammers, but actually you need that 25K to be in the community and the 15K in the hospital. Or maybe you need the 25K, Phil would say, in the hospital as well, right? So just getting that investment right. So yes, we're investing more, but we're not necessarily investing it in the right places. And so I think that's a big part of it, is getting the reform right and then for people to begin to experience that better care. I think that tangible, that people can bring, they're not afraid to bring an older person to an emergency department, that they can bring a child to a GP without the fear of not having the €60 to pay for the visit or the drug bill in the prescription. So I think that constantly improving and having tangible examples of the reform is a really big thing. I think part that has been missing, the sort of the key missing link from Sláinte Care, which sort of was beginning to happen, there was momentum around it at the end of 2019 and early 2020, and then obviously COVID happened, was this engagement with the public and the community. So actually to date, it's been a very, what they call top-down policy reform. And actually we know that the most successful reforms are the reforms that engage the people on the front line. So cancer care was really well reformed because we engaged all the people providing cancer care. But for that whole health system reform to happen, then we need to engage individuals and communities. And really have let them have a voice and a say, not just tokenistic stuff, but real meaningful engagement and much more bottom-up engagement. And then I think the third part of that is just about good information. And I think it was extraordinary in those early weeks and months of COVID that most of the country was glued to the Tony Holohan news briefing every evening, and we all became epidemiologists, even though we're not at all, and you know, we all had the facts and the figures. And but the public really understood it, and in fact, the public were ahead of the scientists at times. Do you remember Philip Nolan saying antigen testing are snake oil? You know, Philip Nolan was wrong, right? Tony Holohan said, oh, you know, with masks, there was some delay in masking and the people were wearing their own masks. You know, so an empowered, informed people, I think, is also key to it. Whereas if people feel that structures or new systems are being imposed upon them without their engagement, then they won't buy into it.
I wonder if I can conclude by asking all three of you a simple but, you know, sort of magical question, which is if you were Minister for Health, or I suppose maybe in some senses Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform. We'll go straight to the top for a day, and you wanted to change one thing in the health system, or if you would see one thing change in the health system over the next few years that you think would make the biggest difference from your perspective, Phil, what would it be?
Definitely the clinical voice has to have a stronger input. Kind of like what Sarah was saying, it's not that managers don't have a place, but clinicians and their voice is secondary in our public health service. I think the professionals, for example, nurses, doctors, physios, OTs, they're all regulated professionals, have to answer to the regulatory board as well as their employer. Yet their ability to practice safely is determined by people who manage their work environment and who are not registered. So if a nurse makes a mistake, they can be subjected to a fitness to practice regime that can conclude that they can no longer practice anywhere in the world as a nurse. I mean, that's pretty serious. You can also be sacked from your actual job, but being sacked will be a lesser penalty than being considered struck off your register. In this country, it's a register. In other countries, it's a license. But our management colleagues don't have that, and I think they should have it. So I think that that's the biggest change. Everybody who works in the area of human health must have somebody other than their employer to respond to about decisions, about what's your priority here. Like, look at the Children's Hospital and the overspend. I don't know, do we want to get into that?
Well, we don't have
not for 3 minutes to go.
The requisite time.
Who is going, you know, it's not that I think we should be focused on getting somebody to blame. I don't believe in that culture at all. But I think there has to be accountability. And there's no point in having clinicians who are responsible, but they don't have accountability or they don't have decision-making authority to influence the areas in which they work.
So, Monica, what would your... What would your one change be if you were Taoiseach for the day?
Taoiseach.
And had a magic wand.
Oh, Jesus, maybe not Taoiseach now. Well, I suppose, yeah. Maybe the Minister of Health. And it's just from my perspective, I feel there should be better access for all, and it shouldn't be dependent on your income. So that's one of the things that frustrates me. I see it in my elderly patients, I see it in younger people as well. It shouldn't be income-based. I think it should be better, if I can't say the word free, but there should be better access for everyone. That's what I'll try to
Something
achieve.
That I would definitely also agree with. Yeah. And Sarah, I'll give you the last word if you were in charge.
Well, I like, obviously, both the previous ones, and I think Phil's accountability governance is really key, and I think that's one of the missing links of us getting the reform right or wrong to date, is we haven't got the governance right, and Sláinte Care is all about access to care based on need, ability to pay. But I think it's that piece, that missing piece I was talking about earlier, I think it's the engagement of the public and the communities. And in the previous panel, we were talking about Ireland being at the forefront of deliberative democracy, citizens' assemblies. We're just about in February 2024, so next February, very soon, where there are new regions being put in place across the country. And I think that's a real opportunity to really engage citizens and communities. I think it's an opportunity that'll be missed, but if I was in power for a day, I'd put structures in place, because I think that often, as was said earlier, people can really cut to the chase and stuff, and they understand that money's being misspent, and if they have a say in how the services are planned and delivered, and also understand those accountability governance mechanisms, I think we could have a much better system. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all three of you for joining me. It's been really fascinating to chat with you. Thank you all for the work that you do improving the health service and in working in the health service. As I say, my family are indebted hugely to the people in University Hospital Kerry after this last year, as I know many families around the county are. And I hope that all of these ideas, you know, hopefully when we're back here in a few years' time, we'll all be saying it's great that the Sláinte Care journey has progressed in the way that we all hope that it will. So thank you to all three of you for joining.
Thank you so much to Sarah Burke, Monica Oike, and Phil Nihay for joining me in Dingle. On next week's episode, we speak to the creative minds of Dumbworld about AI and the future of opera. To make sure you don't miss that or any of our future episodes, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Southwind Blows production, and I'm Christopher Kassan. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to your company next time on Ireland's Edge.